We've come to Jacob setting out again from Beersheba. This time he's going down to Egypt. What you get with Jacob going down to Egypt is a genealogical list, of which there are a number in the Bible. And there are lots of discussions. We're now on, by the way, chapter 46, verse 5. Okay? 46, verse 5. So Jacob set out from Beersheba. The sons of Israel, in other words, his children, but now notice how they're playing with his name. He starts off as Jacob, but then they become the sons of Israel because they're about to constitute a people. Here begins the transition from family to nation, so from Jacob to Israel. The sons of Israel put their father Jacob and their children and their wives in the wagons that Pharaoh had sent to transport him. So they take a certain ownership and responsibility for this mission, which of course was their doing in the first place in a very real sense. They also bring their own families. And this is one of those instances where the silence of women's voices in the Torah is particularly notable, if you're aware of it. And I actually did not look, although I'll try to do it this week, at the women's commentary to see what it says. But this has been all about the brothers, and now all of a sudden they come home and they say, listen, dear, we're moving to Egypt. It's lovely this time of year. But there there's food. Well, the other thing is, if you were writing this as a novelist, as Thomas Mann actually did, but if you're writing this as a novelist, wouldn't you wonder whether the brothers told their wives what they did to Joseph? And if they didn't, then do they have to tell them now? Right? Sometimes these delayed revelations don't help things very much. I was just reading Jonathan Lear, who's a British philosopher, wrote a book about Freud. And I was just reading it, and he has in a footnote about the story of a friend of his who discovered in his 30s from his parents that he was adopted. And when he said to them, why didn't you ever tell me before? And they said, well, we tried to tell you when you were 6 years old, but you put your fingers in your ears and you screamed that you didn't want to hear it. So we decided to let it go. And you do wonder, at least I wonder, first of all, not necessarily every marriage between the brothers was the same, but I do wonder if they shared with their wives what they had done to Joseph, or if they didn't. And the fact that there's no mention is pretty intriguing, because the way that it reads here is essentially the brothers just place their families in the wagons to transport them. And they took along their livestock and their wealth that they'd amassed in the land of Canaan. So in other words, they've done very well, and they're taking everything with them, and they're going down to Egypt to this unknown fate, but in Egypt there's food. It reminds me, I shouldn't say this. But I can't resist. I know. I will. Yes. Thank you, Janet. I appreciate that. Do any of you remember a comedian named Sam Kinison?
Yes.
He was a loud, heavy, vulgar, hilariously funny comedian who overdosed, as all such comedians are supposed to. It's written into their contracts. In his 30s, he overdosed and died, which was a shame because he was really actually brilliantly inventive, but really vulgar and off color. And the other day, as a bad father will, I played a routine of his for my daughter. But the routine was about, it's actually a very funny routine where he talks about how to solve world hunger. And he says, I have the solution. And I'm not going to do the routine for you because he screams it, basically. And that's part of the humor, is the way that he screamed a lot during his routine. He says, you know, I was reading the paper how they were trucking all this food to these tribes in Ethiopia where there's a famine and there's hunger. He says, and the solution is don't give them any more food. He said, give them trucks and take them from where there is no food to where there is food. Instead of bringing all this food to the tribes in Ethiopia, he says, you should say to them, it doesn't rain here. Crops don't grow here. Get in the truck and we'll bring you to where there's food. Except he doesn't put it quite that way. But I'm just thinking that the same thing is true here, which is you can't bring enough food to Canaan to solve the problem. So instead, I know that to bring Sam Kinison as a commentator on the Torah is questionable at best. But it was just 2 days ago that I played that routine for my daughter. as a way of illustrating points of Torah, of course. I would never otherwise do this. But that's exactly what they're doing here, is they're loading into the wagons and they're bringing everybody to Egypt because that's the one place in the world at the moment, because of Joseph's foresight, where there is a stockpile of food. And so they brought, it says, and it, here it says explicitly, he brought with him to Egypt his sons, his grandsons, his daughters and granddaughters, all his offspring. And this, as you know, is a point that is, and maybe this is what the Bible is trying to do here, is to forestall this point, which is that the question of modern scholarship is, did any Israelites grow natively from Canaan, or were they all in fact in Egypt and came to Canaan? And there's a very widespread school of thought that in fact part of what we think of as Israelites were Canaanites who grew up in Canaan, and in some way or other, whether because of ancient traditions or because they allied themselves with the incoming tribes, became part of Israel. But here, you notice that the Torah is trying to say explicitly, all the Jews went to Egypt, everybody. Nobody left in Canaan, everybody went to Egypt. And in fact, it even gives you the names of all the Israelites, and you'll notice that what it does is it gives you the names of the sons, right? Except for Dina. Dina is mentioned because she's already been mentioned. We know about Dina, right? It says, these were the sons whom Leah born to Jacob in Padan Aram. I'm reading verse 15. In addition to his daughter Leah, persons in all, male and female, 33. And the reason that we have this wonderful, in verse 17, if you look at verse 17, you see it says, Asher's sons, Imna, Ishva, Ishvi, and Beria. And then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, and their sister Serach. Now, what you discover is when you get the genealogical lists of the Israelites who are leaving Egypt, you also have a woman named Serach bat Asher. So the rabbis, of course, seize on this. And what they say is that Serach bat Asher is the only one who went down with the Israelites and lived long enough to go back to the desert with them. And it was to Serach bat Asher that Moses turned when he promised, you know, Joseph made them promise that he would bring his coffin eventually to Israel after the liberation. But who knew where Joseph's coffin was? So Moses went to Serach bat Asher, and she's the one who told him how to find Joseph's coffin and bring it back to Israel. And that's based not only on the coincidence of the fact that there are two people named Serach bat Asher, or the two times when the name Serach bat Asher is used, but also because you can see how improbable it is that all of a sudden a female is named among all these sons. Dina, we understand, because we already know that Dina's there, and the reader's going to say, well, where's Dina? But Serach bat Asher must be named for another purpose. So the rabbi sees on that, as you would expect them to do. And then you get all the sons and Dan's sons. Let's go to verse 26. I'm not going to talk about, there are all sorts of commentaries on the genealogical list, but we can, for the moment, put it aside with just the question of why genealogical lists are included. And they have a certain music in the Hebrew, and they lend a certain veracity to the narrative. That is, if you can give the specific people who came down, then it makes it seem much more likely that they actually came down. Also, lists play a really important role in in literature in general. In fact, Umberto Eco, the guy who wrote The Name of the Rose, wrote a book about lists, just the idea of lists in literature and in life. And he talks about the fact that human beings are, you have a woman's commentary, so actually good, we can take a look at it in a second. It talks about how human beings are list-making creatures, which is very much true. If you notice, if I give you two articles and one says some important things to know about how to dress, and the other one is the 10 most important things to know about how to dress, you're going to read the second. Because there's something about lists that naturally draws us, about shopping lists, about all sorts of lists. Somehow lists seem to organize the world, whether they do in fact or not. And so there is a certain organizational principle too. Can you tell me if it says anything about?
At the actual moment of listing, it says about Dina, it may be significant that she is listed here.
Okay.
And about their sister Sarah, it says, Ashley's
Sarah.
Daughter.
Yes.
It says that Sarah is the only daughter of any of Jacob's sons mentioned in the genealogy. And it appears again in Numbers.
Right. But does it say anything about the earlier time when it doesn't talk about? I'm asking about verse 5 and 6. That's what I wanted to know. The list I know. About Sarah we know, and about Dina we know. But does it say anything on verse 5 or 6? No? Ah, they missed an opportunity. What can I tell you? Anyway, so that sense of us are being list-making creatures, and also about lists concretizing and making more real. In literature, sometimes you'll see that, and he brought along this one, and this one, which makes it feel much more real than if you just say brought along a bunch of people. So all the persons, going back to verse 26, all the persons belonging to Jacob who came to Egypt, and belonging is kol ha-nefesh ha-ba'al li Yaakov, all the souls who came to Jacob. It doesn't necessarily mean ownership, right? It's all the people who were with him. His own issue, aside from the wives of Jacob's sons, all these persons numbered 66, and Joseph's sons who were born to him in Egypt were 2 in number. Thus, the total of Jacob's household who came to Egypt was 70 persons, because you include Joseph and Jacob, right? Or Jacob and or Joseph and his wife, depending on how you count.
What happened to all the people that were not his family, but served their
family? It doesn't say whether it. I mean, it says at the beginning their children and their wives. It doesn't say anything about servants, right? It just says livestock and wealth. So we don't know. We just don't know. I mean, would they have left them behind? Were they Canaanite servants who didn't want to go to Egypt? It doesn't say. So we don't know. But it makes a big point of saying that they came down as 70 people, because later on, the multiplication of the Jews is going to be the issue. Right? The fact that they become such a large number inside of Egypt is what Pharaoh is going to cite as the threat to Egypt's integrity and sovereignty and so on, and that's why they enslave them. But it begins with 70 people who go down to Egypt, and as you know, 70 is a representative number. 7 is always a representative number, just like 10 is a representative number, and 3 is a representative number. But here, unlike other times, it seems to be deliberately planned out that there would be exactly 70 people to go down. And it doesn't, in earlier cases, it does say, in fact, that servants went, like servants go with Abraham, but it says nothing about them in the case of Jacob, so maybe it was just the family that went down. And you can imagine that, because they would think, A, we're going to be able to get servants in Egypt, right? Canaan isn't the only place that supplies servants. And B, we're bringing people down because there's no food. Well, we don't want to bring extra mouths to Egypt, because it's not going to be so easy to get food there. And if we bring our own 70, they'll feed us. But if we bring the servants, they may say, well, you know, there's enough for you, but not enough for your servants. Okay. He had sent Judah ahead of him to Joseph to point the way before him to Goshen. So when they came to the region of Goshen, Joseph ordered his chariot and went to Goshen to meet his father Israel. He presented himself to him, and embracing him around the neck, he wept on his neck a good while. Then Israel said to Joseph, "Now I can die, having seen for myself that you are alive." The ambiguity that exists in the English also exists in the Hebrew. That is, who wept? The pshat, the obvious answer is that Joseph wept because he's the subject of the sentence, but it could be either one. It says, V'yipol al tzavarav v'yef. He fell on his neck and wept. Al tzavarav od. On his neck some more. So it seems like it's Joseph who wept. You could argue it either way in terms of the psychological reality of the event, although it's got to be more shocking for Jacob than for Joseph, because Joseph has imagined this reunion many, many, many times, but Jacob didn't, right? And also Joseph is going to look probably more different to Jacob than Jacob will to Joseph. They're both going to look different, but Joseph's going to look more different. I mean, he left as a 17-year-old, and now he's a 37-year-old. That's a lot of change. So what it reminds you of, though, of course, is that the other person that Joseph, whose neck Joseph weeps, is Benjamin, and it emphasizes that this is all he really has left of his family. His half-brothers, even though they're his family, he's got to feel ambivalent about at best, but this is his mother's son, and this is his father. These are his full biological relatives as opposed to half relatives who betrayed him. So let me just get to the end of this one. Let's just get to the end of this one chapter, and then we'll take questions. The other thing is what Israel says to Joseph is very interesting, that now I can die, as opposed to just saying, I'm happy to see you. It was just the other day, I recommend to you a very powerful article written by Christopher Hitchens in the most recent Vanity Fair about being treated for cancer at MD Anderson, and that several times he really contemplated, would it just be better to die? And later when he recovered, he said, I was in the peculiar position of wondering, would it have been better had I died? Which is a different question from right now, I'd just like to die. And he quotes the philosopher Sidney Hook, who went through the same experience, of grave illness and terrible, torturous treatments, and talked about his bed in the hospital as a mattress grave. And you wonder at what point someone reconciles themselves to death and says, it's okay if I die now, because the essentials, either life is too unbearable to go on living, right? Which, I mean, he had esophageal cancer, so they gave him the maximum amount of radiation that they could give, and every time he swallowed, he was in agony, and they're giving him shots to his vocal cords and all sorts of treatments that are quite painful and unpleasant, but it's a very powerful article. The article is all about the motif of the article is all about Nietzsche or Goethe, it depends who you ask, phrase, what doesn't kill me makes me stronger, and how untrue that is, right? How ridiculously untrue that is, because sometimes what doesn't kill you weakens you. It doesn't make you stronger, actually. And so the treatment isn't killing him, but it's certainly not making him stronger. Anyway, it's a very moving article. But the two sides of it are when life becomes too unbearable and you would rather die, or when you feel like it's not that I want to die, but that I could die now in perfect peace because all of my major life goals that are really important have been satisfied. I mean, despite the fact that obviously there's always more, and as the Midrash says, everybody dies with more than half of their wishes unfulfilled. And if that's not true, then you don't wish enough. But I mean, all you have to do is like, you have to walk into a bookstore and there are 1,000 books you have to read before you die and 1,000 places you have to visit before you die and 1,000, you know, restaurants you have to try, and you realize it can't happen. Jacob's comment is interesting, and actually it does make sense if you think about the fact that he has built a nation, he reconciled with his brother, he buried one wife, and the wife whom he most loved is gone, and his son that he thought he lost is now no longer lost. There isn't a lot left in terms of his life goals. His children are now going to be okay because they're going to go to Egypt, and they've avoided the famine, and Joseph, the other brother, bless you, is going to take care of them. It makes sense for him to say, look, you know, it's enough. And you'll see that that especially is true when you hear his dialogue with Pharaoh, which we'll talk about. Joseph said to his brothers and to his father's household, I will go up and tell the news to Pharaoh and say to him, my brother and my father's household who were in the land of Canaan have come to me. The men are shepherds. They've always been breeders of livestock, and they've brought with them their flocks and herds and all that's theirs. So when Pharaoh summons you and asks, what's your occupation? You shall answer, your servants have been breeders of livestock from the start until now, both we and our fathers, that you may stay in the region of Goshen, for shepherds are abhorrent to Egyptians. So he's coaching them on what to say to Pharaoh. Now, there's a lot of discussion about this, but the usual, why do people hate shepherds? People, I mean, you probably don't hate shepherds, but what is it? Why would shepherds be abhorrent? The people, there's a long-standing clash in history between the nomads, and shepherds are basically nomadic, and the city dwellers. And just think of it this way. Say a shepherd came through Beverly Hills, okay? What's going to happen to your lawn? And that's exactly how people in the cities felt. Shepherds would come through, and the sheep would pasture, and they would pasture on your land, and they would eat your whatever it was that you had in your land, and then the shepherds would move on. And Egypt is settled along the Nile. Egypt is cities. Egypt isn't this nomadic culture which Canaan was. You know, if you go to Canaan, there wasn't so much cities as there were all these hills and fields and so on. Later on it became cities, but early on it was shepherds, and so the Egyptians don't like people who are shepherds, and they feel threatened. People who raise livestock, that's fine, because you raise livestock on your own land, right? Livestock don't graze on other people's lands. And a lot of ancient law, a lot of Talmudic law, is all about boundaries and borders, and what happens if there's a fruit that's from a tree on your land, but it overhangs my land. Do I get to pick that fruit if the branch overhangs my land? And in fact, Rabbi Yirmiyah is one of these great moments in the Talmud where they talk about, I think it was a bird, where it's talking about the boundary, and if the bird dies on this side of the boundary, then it belongs, even though it's a bird and doesn't belong to anyone, if it dies on this side of the boundary and falls on your land, then it belongs to you. And if it falls on this side of the boundary, then it belongs to the other. And Rabbi Yirmiyah says, what if it falls with one leg on this side and one leg on the other side? And after he asks that, the next phrase is, and they kicked Rabbi Yirmiyah out of the academy. Literally, that's what it says. So I don't know whether he was probably, to go back to what I said at the very, he was probably a little like Sam Kinison, who knows. So that question of the shepherds and the settled community runs all through not only the Bible, but through other ancient histories, the way in which the two modes of life clashed. But you can see that Joseph is making sure that his brothers will be okay, and that he has to play Pharaoh, so to speak, so that Pharaoh will accept them and that he's taking care of them. But this is clearly a way of his taking care of them. And you'll notice that he says it very, very, my father said they were in the land of Canaan and they've come to me, okay? So he doesn't say anything about the history or about the estrangement. It's just they lived in Canaan and now they're coming to see me because obviously, you know, I'm the viceroy of Egypt, so I can take care of them and make sure that they're good. But the other thing is, when he says, look at what he says. He's not going to lie to Pharaoh. Right? He's not going to. He's going to say to Pharaoh, they're shepherds and they breed livestock. But when Pharaoh asks them, he wants them only to say, we breed livestock. So that he can keep the integrity of his relationship to Pharaoh, but Pharaoh will know that they're not going to be engaged in that occupation anymore. They used to do that, but they're not going to do it now. Okay. which is a really, I mean, it's there's so much in that exchange that tells you something about Joseph's relationship to Pharaoh and his relationship to his family and also his diplomatic skills, because he's playing both sides of this, which is he doesn't want Pharaoh to find out later that they were shepherds and Joseph never told him, which is not hard to find. You got to figure, you know, if that's what they spent their whole life doing, it's going to leak out somehow. But he wants Pharaoh to know that he's arranged it so they won't be shepherds anymore, and they know that too. And also, Joseph has decided where they're going to stay, right? In Goshen. So there's going to be a community where they will be able to stay with. He doesn't say, now go find homes in the land of Egypt. They're going to stay together in one place, in one region, where they'll be able to take care of each other and so on and so forth. All right. Let's stop there because that's the end of the chapter and take questions and comments. Yes?
Does the land of Goshen actually exist?
Yes, the land of Goshen actually exists. It's not called Goshen anymore, I don't think, but the region is real. Now remember, I want to say just one thing about this, which is the people who lived in Canaan knew a lot about Egypt. Even if they never went to Egypt, they knew a lot about Egypt because Egypt controlled Canaan for a lot of its history. So they knew as much about Egypt as America knew about Britain, even Americans who were born here, right? Not that Egypt colonized Canaan, but they ruled it. Having said that, yeah, the region of Goshen exists, and I don't know whether in ancient times it was a place that slaves were known to live or not, but that wouldn't be too hard to find out, I assume.
Where is Canaan?
Yes. Where Canaan is Israel. That's what Canaan means, Israel. That's what Canaan means. It doesn't mean that, I mean, but that's what... The land of Canaan was taken over by the Israelites and became Israel. Yeah. Angela?
That was my question.
Oh, yes. Yes.
So
he knew because he heard before that Joseph's brothers had come to visit. Remember from the last scene, from last time. That's how he knew. Whether he knew before that, I don't know. Yeah.
There's no mention of land ownership.
Not specifically, but presumably they had land. If you have cattle and livestock and so on and so forth, I assume you have land on which to pasture it. But yeah, but well, it's hard to know how land was bought or sold or divided in ancient times. I mean, part of it, I'm sure, was military, and you had to be able to defend your land. And part of it was probably ownership and trade and so on. I mean, from ancient times, people presumably owned land in different places. But
what I'm wondering is, they just got up and left it all behind.
Yeah. Well, maybe they sold it. I mean, maybe, you know, they had a big sign that said moving sale, and they were off to Egypt. But also if the land was fallow and there was a famine, there was no point to it anyway. I mean, just to have land, it's not. I mean, the point of land then obviously was no longer to build; it was to live on and to pasture. That was the only point of land. So if you couldn't pasture it, and nobody wanted to live there because there was no, it couldn't support you, then it was worthless.
The reason I'm saying is because for current events now, as far as whether Israel belongs to the Jewish tribe,
right,
Jewish
right,
race or not, they just let it all go. You could argue that they let it go.
Well, the claim of Israel, the biblical claim of Israel on the land of Israel is twofold. One is that it's promised. God promised it. And the second is that the Israelites have had possession of that land for thousands of years, because after the Exodus, when they come back to Israel and they conquer Canaan, it's theirs. And since there are no Canaanites left, there's nobody to claim ownership before the Israelites. That's why, remember, Rashi asks the question. This is a very famous question at the beginning of, on Genesis 1:1, the very first verse of Genesis. Rashi, the most famous commentator in Jewish history by far, nobody else comes close. If you get any classical copy of the Chumash, it always has Rashi's commentary printed next to it. And if you get any copy of the Talmud, it always has Rashi's commentary printed next to it, right? He lived in France in the 10th, in the 11th century. Rashi's comment on the beginning of Genesis, on the first verse, is something that would occur, I think, to none of us. He says, why doesn't Genesis begin with chapter 12? Why does it begin now? Because chapter 12 is the beginning of, that's when Abraham gets his mission, and it's the first laws, right? You get circumcision. And why doesn't it begin with that? What's all this business about who created and the flood? Why do we need that? It's not relevant to Jewish law, so what's the point? And his answer is, because the Torah had to tell you that God created the world and therefore may assign the lands of the world any way God chooses. In other words, Israel's claim to the land of Israel is built into the very structure of creation. That's his point. So the classical justification is, doesn't matter what happened militarily, God said, Abraham, this land is yours, and go argue with God, which, you know, only works if you believe it.
How old is from the time of Joseph to Moses?
From Joseph to Moses is all, I mean, the captivity is about 280 years. The total time is supposed to be about 400 years.
So the whole Sarah story,
yes. But then it's not a question of making sense. That's exactly what the rabbis say, that she lived hundreds of years so that she could accompany the Israelites from... But they multiplied greatly. So it depends what successful means. If successful means you'll become a nation instead of a people, then they did.
So.
Right, that left Egypt. Yeah.
I'm wondering, what was the number of Jews when they left? 70, or they were just descended?
When they left Egypt?
No, when they left Canaan.
Seven. Altogether, there were 70. When they left Egypt, 600,000 men.
There were only 70 Jews, and they were all children of Israel.
Of Jacob. Jacob. Well, they weren't all children. They were grandchildren, wives. They were all his family.
And nobody
yes.
else.
And nobody else, at least not according to what the Torah says. Yes. Well, we'll get to that in a minute. We'll get to that when it's because Jacob blesses them in reverse order. Mm-hmm. He blesses the younger before the older. Yeah. Right, that's a really good point. He said it reminds him of the lineage in the second book of the Iliad, all the ships that Homer lists, and it's in part because people trace their lineage to this or that tribe or group or whatever name. And here, too, you've got to figure that the readers would know that they came from this tribe or that tribe or the other tribe, and they can see the names of their ancestors. And it's probably true that those names were repeated again and again and again and again throughout history. So you get that same thing, you know, certain names in certain families recur over and over and over and over and over again throughout the generations. And so you identify with, you know, if you're a member, let's say, of the tribe of God, and there's an Ezbon here, so you say, that's what my name is also Ezbon. So obviously in God, in the tribe of God, that name got passed through the generations. Yeah.
At what point in history that region started to be called Palestine?
Under the Romans. The Romans called it Palestine.
And why?
Because they renamed the province after the rebellion of the Israelites and named it for in Latin as a Roman province because they wanted to claim it as their own. So it's from the Latin. It's not a Hebrew. Yeah, next question. Go ahead.
Another reason to list the names is they have meaning.
Yes. Right. Yes. Happiness. It is happiness or wealth. Right. Many of the names have meaning. All the Hebrew, almost all Hebrew names have meanings. And the ones that we don't know, they had meanings almost certainly. We just don't know them now. The question still is, though, why would you want to list all these names? So they had meanings, but why would you? But why does it matter to list them? Although, when you have a character whose name affects his story, then you would understand it. And that happens, for example, in the story of David. But the reason that I dismissed the Palestinian question is because there's a lot of debate about where Palestinians come from and who they are. And I don't want to get into it, although they claim that they go back into the land thousands of years. It's not a productive debate for us at the moment. Yeah. Because even though he's not the first son, he's the sort of presumptive leader of the sons. As we saw earlier on, Reuven sort of, you know, bows out. So Judah was the one, remember, who comes to Jacob and says, you can kill my kids if we don't bring him back, which was not a really helpful suggestion, but still shows some initiative, after all. Yeah.
Does the word Goshen have a meaning in Hebrew?
Not that I'm aware of, though it might. I have to check the commentary, but it probably does in Egyptian. It's probably an Egyptian name. There are a lot of these words are Egyptian words. You know, Moses is an Egyptian word, and Aaron is an Egyptian word, and Pinchas is an Egyptian word. A lot of Egyptian words in the Bible, especially names. Yeah. I can't hear.
They left
Dina. No, it's, she's in here. She is in here. Dina. She is in here. No. Right, then he leaves her out, yes. Because blessing goes to the sons. Blessing doesn't go to the daughters in the Bible. The blessing goes to the sons primarily because what does blessing most involve?
Land,
right? Blessing is really about possessions and land, and women can't possess land until the time of the daughters of Tzlofchad, where that issue comes up. My father didn't have any sons, can't we have the land? The answer to which, by the way, is yes. But in terms of blessing, if you have sons, sons get the land, and daughters don't get the land. This morning on Facebook, which I know you all check every morning, last night I read this wonderful quote from Virginia Woolf. And she said, I won't quote it exactly, but she said, something like, it's terrible to be locked out, but it might be even worse to be locked in. And I wondered if she was commenting on the relative position of women and men. That women are locked out, but men tend to be locked in. And here you see an example of women being locked out, right? I don't know if that's, in the context, I read it in an essay by someone else, so I don't know if that was the context of it. If it was in a room of one's own, that was probably exactly what she was talking about, but I don't know. Yeah.
So it says, Shimon's sons enlist them, and Saul, the son of a Canaanite woman. So why is that distinguished, that Saul is from a Canaanite woman?
Probably because, where is it, which verse? Probably because he doesn't count as as a full son. It's probably someone that Shimon, my assumption is that it's someone that Shimon took that he wasn't supposed to, who never somehow got absorbed into Israel. Because
and that's one of the names that
right.
continues to be passed down.
Yes, it's true. Well, look, we all know that by being a renegade, you can also get remembered, right? There are two ways to be remembered, you know? It was his least successful show, I think, but Stephen Sondheim had a show called Assassins.
Yeah.
Okay.
Put it on here.
Oh, really? A high school?
Yes.
Anyway, but the point is that one of the motivations is that, you know, you get remembered. Mm-hmm. You shoot the president, someone's going to remember you.
Yeah.
So,
Rabbi,
yeah.
The commentary does
comment
on that.
Okay, what does it say?
Territorial expansion by these tribes and intermarriage
There you go. Territorial expansion and intermarriage. Yeah. And just like the Jews of America. The Shaul was the son of Dinah by the Canaanite. So in other words, they were hiding. So what Rashi is basically saying is they were hiding it by calling it Shimon's son by a Canaanite woman, where it was really Dinah's son by a Canaanite man. Okay. Fair enough. Yeah.
Was it Reuven who led the revolt to defend the honor of Dinah earlier?
No, it was Shimon and Levi. Shimon, that's why Shimon gets the, yeah.
And they're known, is it written that this is known, this followed them to Egypt?
Well, it doesn't say it followed them to Egypt, but Jacob says something about it in his final blessing to them. Yes. But it doesn't say anything about the Egyptians being aware of it. I mean, look, it's a local skirmish in Canaan. The Egyptians don't, I don't think, take any. In Canaan, it was. It was a local, big story in the local news. But I don't think that it was, that it made the Egyptian papers. So, do you ever see Chronicles? They used to do, I don't know if they still have those. They had, when I was a kid, they used to give them to the bar mitzvah kids. They were the events of the Bible put in newspaper form. Yeah. And you would get these newspapers, you would open them up and they would have newspapers and, and they would have the headline like, thousands of Israelites crossed the sea. And then underneath it says, Pharaoh and his armies drowned, and then it would have the article, and it was very cleverly done. So my assumption is that even though there was some overlap, what went on in Canaan was of minimal interest to anybody in Egypt, because remember that there's more. I once saw this statistic that there was more news on the front page of the New York Times than the average villager in the Middle Ages knew about the world in his whole life. The only thing you knew about was what happened in your village. You knew there was a king, but you didn't know anything about state or whatever, and you never left your village. And that was the way in which, and your village was a few hundred people, and you knew everyone in your village, and you knew everything about their lives, and nothing outside your village, nothing at all, which is why all these old stories are about a stranger coming to town. It's like that was the big news, was someone, and we live our lives in a very, for the way human beings evolved, in a very artificial way, which is we first of all know vast numbers of people compared to, and we have relationships with people that we don't know, which is why there's this strange phenomenon. I once spoke to, several years ago, I spoke to this actress who was very well known. She wasn't really acting anymore, but she was very well known when she was younger. And she talked to me about the fact that she had been learned along the way that the human brain was wired so that when you see someone and they see you, there's something deep in your brain that assumes that you know them, even if they see you on TV. She said, so people will speak to me in a way that assumes an intimacy that they know in their minds they don't have. They know that. They're not stupid people. But we're so wired to see someone and to create that intimacy with them that they really feel like they know me, even though they know they don't, and they speak to me in a way that's much more personal than if they just met me. And so you realize how many things we're wired for that the modern world sort of rejiggers or makes different, because we're really wired to be in a village of a few hundred people and not to have relationships with Madonna, whom we just, but it does sometimes happen to you that, especially in Los Angeles, that you'll see someone and you'll think you know them, and then you realize that actually they're actors. Right? And for a second you thought, oh, this is a friend of mine. And then you realize, no, it's not a friend of mine. They're on Miami CSI or whatever. But you think they're a friend of yours because a familiar face is, we're wired to assume that it's somebody that we know. So I got to assume that the people in Egypt had no concern about what went on in Canaan unless it directly affected their lives. And as channels of communication grew and proliferated and so on, everything started to change, which was why things like railroads and telegraphs were mind-boggling advances to people, just mind-boggling advances, because the idea that someone could say something far away and it could reach you in a matter of minutes is just, I mean, now to us it's an everyday occurrence, but anyway.
Still not clear. I mean, I always kind of puzzling this, what you were talking about.
Louder.
still not clear about the 46, chapter 47 about the brothers being, telling the Pharaoh that his brothers are shepherds. And then they're saying, but they'll be in Goshen. It sounds like he's saying, well, Goshen is far away from the Egyptians, or it's already cattle country. Because then the Pharaoh said, well, okay, I'm going to put them over my cattle.
No, it
doesn't seem to be a negative thing.
It's not, the livestock thing is not a negative thing.
Yeah.
The shepherd thing is a negative thing. But over cattle is fine.
But where does it say that they're not being shepherds?
Because he says, you shall answer, your servants have been breeders of livestock from the start until now, both we and our fathers, so that you may stay in the region of Goshen. Because he wouldn't let you in Goshen if you were shepherds. That's the implication.
Oh,
yeah.
I see. It changes. We breed.
That cattle can't eat it, exactly. Right. Sheep will like, they're like locusts with fur. Yeah.
But he says, they say, we are your servants, we are your servants, our shepherds, as were also our fathers, but we don't have any. So I'm still,
Joseph says to Pharaoh,
yeah,
they were shepherds. They raise livestock, and when you talk to Pharaoh, you just tell him you raise livestock. So Pharaoh knows you're not going to be shepherds anymore, so that he'll let you stay in Goshen. So that he'll let you stay in Goshen. Yeah, Jerry.
Okay. But then we get to chapter 47. Pharaoh says, what is your occupation? And they answer, shepherd.
I know. We'll get to that. Wait. We haven't gotten to that yet. We didn't do chapter 47 yet. Wait. We'll get to that next time, right? But right now, we understand what the point is, right? Okay. Why they don't follow Joseph's direction, we will talk about. But at the moment, Joseph's direction is very clear.
Right?
Yes. Yes. No, it's exactly right. Right. Nomads are, right, are country bumpkins.
Yeah.
Right? And people in cities are civilized, just like now. I mean, it's one of the reasons why in Europe, the Roma, the gypsies, are looked down on. Mm-hmm. Because they're nomadic. And nomads don't, and in fact, I'll take one last comment, and then I'll tell you what Soloveitchik said about nomads. And then we'll finish. Yeah. Not to lie, to omit. Which is true. They raise livestock. He just didn't say that we also raised sheep. Diplomacy, I actually think you do understand diplomacy. Everyone uses it all the time, right? You can't survive in this world by saying the entire truth all the time. Everybody's diplomatic. You may not understand this particular instance of diplomacy, but I don't know anyone who doesn't use diplomacy to some extent, right? You have to. Diplomacy is another way of saying being considerate of other people's feelings and not shoving in their faces things that will arouse emotions that will be counterproductive to your goal. So he could say to them, we're shepherds, but then Pharaoh's not going to like it. And he's Pharaoh. So I do want to just make this last comment about nomads and farmers. Soloveitchik has this passage where he says, I don't remember whether someone asked him or he was just writing about it. He said, you know, some people go from religion to religion and they take whatever they like in each religion. He said, they're like nomads. Nomads go from field to field and they graze on that field and then they go on. He said, then there are farmers. Farmers stay in one place and they invest in it and they don't go from place to place. He said, the difference is that nomads make nothing grow. So the same thing's true in a religious tradition. Yes, you can go from religious tradition to religious tradition, but you won't grow the same way and you won't help that tradition grow if you go from religious tradition to religious tradition. And presumably there would be no religious tradition unless there were farmers. So. All right, so next time we will do chapter 47 and we will discover, I hope, why it is that the brothers did not follow Joseph's direction.